Yurio Hirano is professor of English at the Sugiyama Women's University in Nagoya, Japan. He became interested in T.S. Eliot during his college days, and in 1975, he completed his B.A. from Kyoto Prefectural University on Eliot, and an M.A. on the poet from the Graduate School of Osaka City University in 1980. In the 90s, his interest shifted from Eliot to Ezra Pound and to Charles Olson. His book on Eliot, and he has two books, he has a book on Eliot and on Pound. The Eliot book is called Modern and Anti-Modern, A Portrait of T.S. Eliot. It's put out by the Eliot Society in Tokyo. And on Pound, Where Memory Lives, Ezra Pound in the Poetry of the 20th Century by the Ezra Pound Society of Tokyo. Professor Hirano began translating the Maximus poems in 1992, and this is his labor here, which is quite a magnificent volume. And 20 years later, in February of 2012, he completed him. The Japan Translators Association awarded Hirano the Japanese Special Prize for Translation in 2012. And he is now publishing a series of essays based on his readings of Muthologos and Human Universe. These essays, he says, try to elucidate, quote, Charles Olson as a maker of poetics. I want to thank them for visiting Gloucester, preparing this talk, which he actually couldn't go out to lunch with us today because he had to focus on finishing it. And he didn't, I should show you this, the manuscript, because he didn't bring his computer, so Naomi wrote out in this beautiful script the whole speech. It's back there. It's quite something. But anyhow, now I'd like to just bring Lise Breen up here.
Well, this is so fun because it was so serendipitous to meet Yurio and Naomi. So I met both of them on Beth Wellen's Working Waterfront Tour because I was trying to gather material for the some of the Harbor Walk content. And it was 2 years ago, almost exactly to the day. And so we were on the boulevard, and Beth had pointed out the fort. And I pipe up and said, "So, can you see Olson's house from here?" And that definitely perked Yurio up, and he marched over to me and asked me if I knew, did I know where Olson's grave was? And that he had been searching, and he had tried to find it, and he wasn't able to. So I tried to describe where Beechbrook was, but I'm not very good with directions, and Gloucester roads don't have any signs, and you know it's not that complicated, but it's hard when you're trying to describe it. So he scrawled his email address into my notebook, and we had met all of 2 minutes, and I had to run and go do something with my son. So a week later, it's a gorgeous September day, and it just had been after torrential rainstorms. And inspired by Yurio's pilgrimage, I decided I'm going to go actually find Olson's grave because I had never seen it. So, you know, it's easy to find Howard Blackburn's grave. It's right by Fisherman's Rest, and that's incredible at Beechbrook. But the rest of the cemetery, you know, there's the standard marble gravestones, and there's the granite gravestones, and it all looks pretty much the same, and everything's decorated with American flags and plastic flowers. Well, finally, surrounded by the ordinary headstones, there was the remarkable, unmistakable, mended black slate death's head, the pilgrim death's head of Charles Olson. And right in front of the grave in this wet, overgrown, meadowy grass was lying in a Ziploc bag, this gorgeous Japanese fan. And I picked it up, and on the back, Yorio, it said something like, "Dear Charles Olson, please know that your Maximus poems will be translated into Japanese and published very soon. Rest in peace, Yorio Hirano." So that was absolutely astonishing, and I left it to grace the grave. I didn't take it. I wish now that I had. I left it, Yorio. And I immediately wrote Henry. Henry, you know, this is incredible. And as Henry just described, Yorio had, and Yorio and I started a little correspondence, and Yorio had begun these translations, which amounted to 1,400 pages of the poems. And it just was so astonishing to us both that on this particular island, you know, separated on another particular island, Yorio would spend so much of his life translating the poems of our particular so grounded poet and all the minute details, the local details that Charles has. And finally, as Henry just showed you this, or last spring, Yorio sent the version. And you have to, when you're here, you have to look at it later. It's so beautifully done on the most amazing paper and with the most beautiful Japanese calligraphy. And since I don't read or speak Japanese, I just get a kick out of looking at the map and the pictures, just like any four-year-old. But that's all I have to say. I just think it's a wonderful treat, and we're so thrilled and grateful that you made the trip back to Gloucester.
Thank you very much. I have no words to say in Olson's town to speak something very good, very nice to you. I do not think of anything. Just I was moved being here, and you came to hear me. I quite moved. That my English is not good, pardon me, but I wrote down it. I made a manuscript because I didn't bring a computer, and I write a manuscript about the 10 pages. And but I cannot read my handwritings. It's a tragedy. And I asked my wife to transcribe my English into her better, fair English. I read her transcription of my original manuscript. It's quite queer, but may I read my papers? Yeah, thank you. What I see in the Maximus Poems of Charles Olson is today's title. I think the Maximus Poems of Charles Olson. Try to rewrite the history of America in its inception, that is, in 1620s. The central drama of the Maximus Poems lies in the opposition between the fishermen who settled in Gloucester in 1624 and the Puritans who settled in Plymouth in 1620s. There are two dimensions in this opposition. The first dimension appears as the opposition between Gloucester people and the Plymouth Puritans struggling over the right for using the fishing stage of Cape Ann. Maximus to Gloucester, letter 11, shows how dangerous this opposition became. The famous inscription of the Tablet Rock suggests the necessary wisdom which stopped the oncoming bloody strife between Gloucester fishermen and the Plymouth Puritans. It was in 1625 when their strife nearly demanded bloodshed. Let us look back and detect the origin of strife over the fishing stage of Cape Ann. The fishing stage of Cape Ann was built by the Plymouth Puritans in 1624, but it was just built and not used. Plymouth people left the fishing stage alone, and in 1625, Gloucester fishermen used the fishing stage for the purpose of fishing. Plymouth people harshly criticized the Gloucester fishermen. This is the root of strife between them. The strife heightened, and everyone thought the bloodshed was inevitable. However, the bloodshed was avoided by the order of Roger Conant, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The tablet rock was built to memorize the wise arbitration of Roger Conant. Let's see the inscription of the tablet rock. See my handout number 1, line 8 from the top. Here, in 1625, Governor Roger Conant, by wise diplomacy, averted bloodshed between contending factors, one led by Miles Standish of Plymouth, the other by Captain Hughes, a notable exemplification of arbitration in the beginning of New England. The tablet rock narrates the beginning of Gloucester as the earliest fishing plantation of Dorchester Company and praises the wise diplomacy of Roger Conant. See number 2 of my handout, line 6 from the top. Miles Standish, who led Plymouth people, is called the Short Chimney because he was short in height and quick-tempered. Standish was nearly shot to death by Captain Hughes, who led Gloucester people. We can hear the taunting tone of the narrator against Miles Standish. Even though he was hot-tempered and short in height, he was a professional soldier. He is depicted as an obdurate but honest soldier in The Courtship of Miles Standish, written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Here, the narrator almost makes a fool of Standish. The fact that a professional soldier is nearly... The fact that a professional soldier is nearly shot to death by a fisherman is somewhat strange. But the strangeness works as a key to interpret the situation. The narrator, Maximus, is on the side of Gloucester fishermen. He does not allow Plymouth Puritans to criticize his people. Neither does he admit Miles Standish, the agent soldier of Plymouth plantations. Plymouth Puritans. The narrator of the story, Maximus, is heavily biased by his distrust of Puritans. Distrust of Puritans and opposition against Plymouth Puritans is a key to rock the true significance of the Maximus poems. Sorry, it's somewhat way of speaking and my English is somewhat queer. Sorry. Pardon. Now, let's return to the wise diplomacy of Roger Conant. The principle of Plymouth people and that of Gloucester people never go together. They just collide. So, arbitration proves to be very important. As the tablet rock says, see my handout number 1, line 3 from the bottom. You see the word arbitration inscribed there. Let me tell more about Roger Conant. He was born in 1592 and died in 1679, age 88. Conant was the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony from 1623 to 1626. In these 3 years, Dorchester Company sent settlers from England to Cape Town. In 1626, Conant led a group of settlers to Naumkeag, later called Salem, and finally moved from Salem to Beverly. Conant founded Beverly to live a calm life, but the people of Salem, the neighboring town of Beverly, called Beverly as Beggary, the town of beggars. Conant felt very sad over such a contemptuous word. Letter 10 of the Maximus poems narrates this story. John Endicott, born 1584 and died 1665, succeeded Roger Conant and became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Endicott was advised by the Dorchester Company to be kind to the old planters, that is, Conant's company, and give them the equal rights as a new planters. However, what Endicott did first was to move Conant's house from Cape Town to Salem. See my handout number 3. The first line, Endicott's first act was to have it dragged to Salem for his own mansion, for his big house. The frame of it was that sound, that handsome, the old carpentry. Roger Conant was betrayed by his successor, John Endicott. The chain of betrayal did not stop in Endicott. Roger Conant was betrayed by his descendant, James Bryant Conant, who was born in 1893. James Bryant Conant was the president of Harvard University from 1933 to 1953. He asked the state of Oregon to send the best student to Harvard. He abandoned the localism of Harvard and destroyed the university. See my handout number 4, line 3 through line 8. Its president, after destroying its localism, meatballs, they called the city fellows, the public school graduates. Conant destroyed Harvard by asking Oregon to send its brightest. James Bryant Conant was criticized by Maximus as a destroyer of Harvard. In contrast to J.B. Conant, our Roger Conant was not a destroyer, but a man who was destroyed, Maximus says in the final line of handout number 4. Roger Conant did not destroy, was in fact himself destroyed, as was the city, 1626. The greatness Roger Conant had was not succeeded to his successor nor to his descendant. The greatness of Roger Conant was reduced to nothing. by the people who sought personal profits. Maximus shows such a history of deterioration to us. That is, what does good in the beginning becomes bad, generation by generation. The result is horrible. See my handout number 5. Endicott robbed Roger Conant of everything. In the beginning of this talk, I suggested that the central drama of the Maximus poems lies in the opposition between the fishermen who settled in Gloucester in 1624 and the Puritans who settled in Plymouth in 1620. I also suggested that there are two dimensions in this opposition. About the first dimension of the opposition, I have talked enough, I guess. Let us go forward to the second dimension of the opposition. It is in letter 23 we witness against the opposition between the Gloucester people. Witness again the opposition between Gloucester people and the Plymouth Puritans. Let us see letter 23, number 6 of my handout. In the beginning of letter 23, we find an explanation for the cause of the stage fight. The second dimension of the opposition between Gloucester people and the Plymouth Puritans is revealed here. The quotation is a little bit long, pardon me. The first 8 lines give the shortest explanation for the settlement of Cape Town. See number 8 of my handout. There you see the year-by-year progression of settlement. It is page 4, the 1623 Voyage of Discovery. 1624, first season, Dorchester Company, the fellowship, 35 tons, 40 men, left stagehead, meaning 40 men were left in stagehead. And the page 5, 1625, the third line, the more than a third part of the lady, the first line, 1625, second season, 32 men left in Gloucester. Then, returning to number 6 of my handout, the opening of letter 23, we find that there develops a detailed description of the first season of settlement, who directed the fishing and who guided agriculture are written there. See line 6 and line 7. John Tilley to oversee the fishing, Thomas Garner the planting. We find the dignified statement of history is developed around these lines. In the passage we are reading, the Dorchester Company's design of building a fishing plantation in the New World is being realized one by one. We watch the outcome of the grand design with breathless interest because Maximus tells us the true founding history of America instead of the false founding history of America by Plymouth Plantation. However, the rewriting of founding history of America does not go smoothly. The right of using the fishing stage prevents the grand design of Dorchester Company from realization, and it blocks the rewriting of founding history of America. See number 6 of my handout. The passage following line 10 from the top. Line 10 reads, but there is the first surprise. The first surprise is the fact that the Puritans had come to Cape Town earlier than the Gloucester people, and that the Plymouth Puritans had already built the fishing stage before the Gloucester people did it. Fishermen and farmers whom the Dorchester Company sent to establish the fishing plantation in Cape Town were preceded by the Puritans. Then it is natural that the Plymouth Puritans got angry when they knew their fishing stage was used by the Dorchester fishermen without permission. The Puritans sent for Miles Standish to take back the fishing stage from Gloucester fishermen. We have already seen the stage fight in my handout number one and number two. However, it is very doubtful why the fishing stage of Cape Town was necessary for the Plymouth Puritans. This fishing stage of Cape Town is too far for the Plymouth Puritans to use. So the fishing stage does not seem to be necessary for the Plymouth Puritans. According to William Hubbard's History of New England, 1898, the fishing stage of Cape Town was necessary for the Plymouth Puritans. The Plymouth Puritans had obtained from King James I of England the useless patent for settling Cape Town. To make this patent useful, they sent a few ships to England in 1623. They expected that the merchant adventurers in England would call for these passengers, for the passengers to America. The aim of the passengers was fishing trade in the New World. It was for this purpose that Plymouth Puritans made their fishing stage at Cape Town in 1624. The fishing stage was no nonsense, either for Gloucester people or for Plymouth Puritans. Both sides claimed their own rights and never conceded. Then came the crisis. Here we can see textual characteristics of the Maximus poems. Beginning of letter 23, that is number 6 of my handout, explains the letter 11, that's number 2 of my handout. In reading the Maximus poems, we sometimes come across a poem or a passage which explains the preceding poem or passage. Olson is a scholar poet. He writes and examines and writes again. So an event is written, rewritten, and revised in the Maximus poems. The fight over the fishing stage is rewritten in History is the Memory of Time. See number 7 of my handout. The year of the fight is corrected from 1625. It was on my handout number 1 to 1625 or 1626. The year of the fight is corrected from 1625. There is a typing mistake in the Japanese version. Number page 4, the middle, I mistyped the, in the Japanese, 1925 or 1926. It was a complete mistake of 1625 or 1626, sorry, that's a grave mistake. As I said, the Maximus poems proceeds in this way. What is narrated is almost identical. However, the narrator's contempt against the Primus people is stronger than the earlier versions of the stage fight. The Primus people are referred to as poor Johns. Sorry, I made another mistake. John is not capitalized. It is a little, not J is just ordinary J, but not capitalized J. That's another typing mistakes. Anyway, the Primus people are regarded as dried cods, that is, weaklings. Compared with the Gloucester fishermen, they are just dried cods, which didn't go fishing and staying in bed. Captain Miles Standish, who took sides with the Primus Puritans, is fully caricaturized here. The man who seemed to hold coal shadow on his head, called Short Chimney in number 2 of my handout, had his slashed trousers ballooning over bow legs. This reminds us of a gunfight scene of Western, or a comic strip of it. However, what is important is not the difference between number 6 and number 7 of my handout. What is important is the identical event is depicted again and again with slight difference. The Maximus poems is not written in chronological order, but has decisively important moments of history to which Maximus returns several times. One of such important moments is the opposition between the Primus Puritans and Gloucester fishermen. It is a moment when the Puritan ideals of founding America crash into the daily lives of naive Gloucester fishermen who settled in Cape Town following the grand design of Dorchester Company. This is a moment when the two founding histories crush each other. Puritans sought the union of religion and politics in New World. The aim of the Dorchester Company and the Gloucester fishermen was fishing. This is the second dimension of the opposition. Let's see the latter half of letter 23. See my handout number 9. The first passage of number 9 narrates that the strife between the Gloucester people and the Primus people over the fishing stage occurred literally in my own front yard. My own front yard, in line 1, we see the poet himself enters in his work. My own front yard is the front yard of the summer house boy Charles Olson spent summer with his parents. The narrator Maximus sometimes becomes the poet Charles Olson. Mark, in line 1, who is treated as a friend of narrator, is Frederick Mark, a historian of Harvard University. When Olson was a student of Harvard, he took the course of Frederick Mark's westward movement and was much influenced. However, in line 1 through 4, Olson seems to make himself more learned than his former teacher. There are two reasons why Olson behaved like this. Reason number 1, the stage fight took place literally in his own front yard. Olson knows the place where stage fight occurred since he was a child. It is not the bookish knowledge, but the lived knowledge. Olson feels himself superior to his former teacher in this respect. Reason number two. Aristotle wrote in his Poetics that the poet is superior to the historian because the poet can write what probably happens, whereas the historian can write just what happened in the past. There may be the two reasons why Olson acts superior to Frederick Mark. See the second passage. There is, I would be a historian as Herodotus was. Olson follows Herodotus when he writes the Maximus poems. The third passage narrates the stage fight again, but the perspective is different from the description of the stage fight preceding this passage. The opposition between the Gloucester fishermen and the Plymouth plantation is not just a strife over the fishing stage. There is an absolute difference between the Gloucester people's way of living by fishing and the Plymouth people's way of living. The latter, that the Plymouth people, acquires the mercantilism and then nascent capitalism. Also sees through the stage fight this opposition, the simple and naive living of Gloucester people does not go with the Plymouth Puritans' mercantilism and its nascent capitalism. Olson has witnessed the opposition between them in his own frontier. See number 10 of my handout. Letter 16 has shown an insight that see through the corruption of capitalism. NE monies means New England money in line one. Nathaniel Bowditch, who became one of the administration board, is the symbol of New England money. He was said to drive out the president, John Thornton Kirkland, from Harvard University and made enemies. On the other hand, he was praised to have saved Harvard from financial difficulties. Bowditch was strong at figures and founded several insurance companies. When he was taking charge of cargoes in Salem, he saw to it that the merchant adventurers might make profits. Nathaniel Bowditch is a personification of New England money. See number 10 on my handout again. He, that is, Bowditch, represents then that movement of New England monies away from primary production and trade to the several cankers of profit making, which have made America great. Meanwhile, of course, throwing up the land and labor, and now the world. The evil of capitalism has been corrupting America since its beginning. See number 11 of my handout. The first man in line four means the Dorchester fishermen, and the second comers in the final line means Plymouth Puritans. In a chronological sense, the truth is in reverse. However, Olson cannot admit that the fishermen came after the Puritans. This is a curse for America. The curse is in number 12 of my handout. December 18th, it means Gloucester, is a part of the country, now a mangled mess of all parts, swollen and foreign into degradation. I was asked to speak a little Japanese before this talk, and I translate it into Japanese here. グロスターは今や叩き潰されてめちゃくちゃになった。この国の一部に過ぎない。あらゆる部分が膨れ上がり、壊滅して大敗状態。Now, what can we do if founding history of America has already been corrupted by capitalism? To answer the question is the biggest task for the Maximus poems. Shall we search the way to save America in the Algonquin legends, which are far from capitalism? Or shall we trace back the ages to the Pennsylvanian period mentioned in Maximus from Dogtown 2, and arrive at the monogeny? Can we find a hint to save America? Or shall we examine the geologies of Cape Verde and become a dialect man? Then is it possible to keep our soul sound enough? And if none of these ways are efficient, should we live day by day cursing America? What Maximus and Olson can do is, doing everything mentioned above, makes his own history and opposes the big letters, capitalized letters, history of nationwide degradation. One example of such a poem is number 13 on my handout. That is just a title. I'm going to hate to leave this earthly paradise. This earthly paradise means Gloucester. It is just the title of a long poem. Olson and Maximus walks around Gloucester through the night, heavily depressed, but never abandoned their hope. In the last, I'd like to see a poem which has a possibility of having more hope, having some hope for the future. See number 14 of my handout. This is a poem. This poem seems just to say that boys and girls grow long-legged, don't like religious ceremonies. If the dead ceremonies of white bulls or surplices of whiteness of the soul suggest pureness of the soul. So, it may come to mean soul of Puritans. The pureness of soul is associated with blindness and ecstasy here. Then, the boys and girls grow long-legged, do not come to good terms with the Puritans and the capitalism, interlocking with the Puritanism. What was shown by the example of Roger Conant, that was the history of deterioration, can be overcome by the boys and girls of the future. If these boys and girls have the simple and naive soul as a farmers and fishermen who settled in Gloucester in 1624, they can end the history of deterioration. Thank you.